Right.
Yes, okay. First, Agenda Paper 6A. So Agenda Paper 6A addresses biological assets growing on bare plants. The submitter had asked the committee, or whether the committee considers fruits growing on oil palms to be an example of a biological asset for which an entity might rebut the fair value presumption, applying paragraph 30 of IS 41. In March, the committee tentatively decided not to add the matter to its agenda. The committee determined that its role is not to conclude upon very specific application questions, particularly when they relate to the application of judgment. We received four comment letters on this tentative agenda decision, which are reproduced in Appendix B. All four respondents agreed with the committee's decision not to add the matter to its agenda. However, two respondents raised additional comments on the tentative agenda decision. Deloitte highlighted that there were three areas related to the valuation of biological assets growing on bare plants that caused difficulty in practice. Deloitte requests that the board consider these areas as part of the PIR of IFRS 13. We will report these concerns to the board. KPMG raised 2 points. Firstly, they note that the tentative agenda decision implies that the fair value measurement of biological assets growing on bare plants might be clearly unreliable only when an entity encounters significant practical difficulties. However, paragraph BC4C of IS 41 does not say that significant practical difficulties are the only reason for an entity to conclude that fair values might be clearly unreliable. We have therefore suggested deleting the word only from the agenda decision. KPMG also say that in their view, reliability of measurement and significant practical difficulties are very different and should not be linked to one another. However, we think that paragraph BC4C of IS 41 already links these concepts in the context of measuring produce. For this reason, we think no further action is required in relation to this concern. We recommend finalising the agenda decision, and the proposed wording is outlined in Appendix A. I will now ask whether you agree with our recommendation to finalise the agenda decision.
Okay, who's first?
I thought I would kick off this time and say I agree with the recommendation in the paper.
Excellent. I like your leadership. Okay. But on that note, can I have a show of hands for who else, in addition to John, supports the agenda decision?
I'm raising my hand.
That's everybody. Thank you. Obviously, you're a powerful man, John. Okay.
Even via video.
Yeah. I'm impressed. Because you're a giant on the screen. Okay. Yeah, so now, Jeffers, IS 19. So 6B.
All right, thank you. We will move on to Agenda Paper 6B on IS 19 and discount rate. The submitter asked how an entity determines the rate used to discount post-employment benefit obligation. In a country that has adopted another currency as its official or legal currency, the committee discussed this issue at its meeting in March and issued a tentative agenda decision. We received 2 comment letters. Both respondents agreed with the committee's decision not to add this issue to its agenda. One respondent suggested some amendments to the wording of the agenda decision. Paragraph 6 notes these suggestions, and paragraph 7 to 10 presents our analysis of these suggestions. Based on our analysis, we recommend finalizing the agenda decision with no changes. Appendix A outlines the proposed wording for the final agenda decision. I will now turn your attention to the question on page 3 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
See nodding heads. Does anybody have anything they want to say? No? All vote. So a show of hands, please, for those who agree with the staff's recommendation to finalise. And John and Sandy?
Yep.
That's everyone again. Thank you.
Just switch your agenda for 7. Jill. Just thought I'd check if you're still awake after lunch.
Okay, now who am I handing over to? Ken?
Yes, thank you.
So, paper 6C.
Thank you. We will now move on to agenda paper 6C on earnings per share. The committee discussed this issue at its meeting in March and issued a tentative agenda decision explaining how entity calculates basic EPS in the fact pattern described in the submission. We received 4 comment letters. 2 respondents agreed with the conclusion reached by the committee. The concerns raised by respondents are noted in paragraphs 14 to 18 of the paper. At its meeting in March, the committee asked us to consider examples applying the committee's tentative conclusions. The examples set out in Appendix B to the paper illustrate how entity would apply the tentative conclusions when it determines the profit attributable to ordinary shareholders over 3 reporting periods. In particular, it illustrates how entity applies the conclusion to situation in which profits earned in 1 period are distributed in later period. I will stop here and ask if you have any questions or comments on our analysis of the comments and on the mechanics of the example in Appendix B.
Yeah, at this stage, we would just like to ask for your input on the mechanics of the example. We will talk later about our recommendation of publishing the example as educational material, and we can talk about the placement and everything at that time. But this is more just on the workings of the example.
Any comments, Reinhardt?
Just briefly, that I found the example very helpful in terms of sure. Understanding how to apply the requirements, and also getting comfort that, as we talked about last time, whether comfort around the issue that there's no double counting. So I found it helpful.
Okay, good. Thank you. Martin.
I just have to echo Reinhard, because I also believe that the example is very useful. As I was 33, anyhow, it's challenging. It really helps to understand what we are talking about.
Okay. Others nodding? Anybody else want to add anything? Marie?
We also consider the example are very helpful. Don't you think it might be useful to send it for comments to make sure that people agree with the example? Because I think some make the comment that maybe you should have also an example of a loss, and what I understand, some people consider the example are maybe too simplistic on some of their aspects. And after, but I think it's the next question, we think it's really helpful to publish them, but maybe as part of the official guidance and not educational material, because I have no clue where it will be in that case, and if you want to make sure that people use them and as it's considered helpful, it's important that everybody is aware of these examples.
Okay. Just on that, I'll just stop for a second on what educational material actually means in the context of an agenda decision. Does that in reality mean, in effect, it's part of the agenda decision because it's attached at the back? So, for example, in the green book where the agenda decisions don't get reproduced, the example would be in that book?
Yeah, so we were thinking it would either be reproduced in the green book or just after the agenda decision, we would say illustrative example and make a clear reference to where it can be found. So it's right there with the and on the new website as well, where we list the agenda decision, where we list this agenda decision and IS-32 will be prominently listed alongside that there is the example available.
Okay, and so we'll come back on
that. So as the minimum, I mean, we haven't worked out in survey, so we'd either, as I say, reproduce it in the green book, or if not reproduced, then we at least suggest at this stage having a reference there to where it is in the website.
Bonnie.
That was actually going to be one of my questions, is can we just include the example in the tentative agenda decision, or the agenda decision? I think it's quite helpful to walk through the mechanics. One other comment or question that I had was paragraph 29 of the page, the last sentence where it talks It addresses one of the questions from the comment letters about the iterative process, if there is a split of the tax benefit between the participating and the ordinary. I think that might be helpful to put in the agenda decision as a conclusion of the overall analysis that we've done, because I'm not sure that that's entirely clear. So I would like to have that in the agenda decision. And I guess to that point, I might also consider that we re-expose or not finalize. I don't know what the right term is, but put it out for comment again, particularly with the example, to make sure there's no further questions on what, how we've interpreted this and what our conclusion is.
Okay. Mary?
I just wondered, I think I'm trying to attach a personal view to what Marie said when I, you know, looked to cite her caution about the example, and you said on the, you did find it helpful, but thought maybe some caution before finalizing it. And it's a, and I want to emphasize personal reaction to this, which is that the example is built on the fact pattern that was submitted, and there's one of the assumptions that I've kind of struggled with from the beginning, which is the assumption that ordinary shareholders and not participating equity holders benefit from the tax benefit. And the reason I struggle with that is I think it's, assuming that the dividends are paid in cash, I think it's very hard to see whether the cash is a distribution of tax benefits or, you know, income that has other sources. So, you know, the example reflects the assumption that, that came in from the submission that that the benefits are enjoyed only by the ordinary shareholders. But because I think very sensibly the example simplifies it down, you're able to see that tracking through. I'm not sure that one always would be, and I'm not sure that as a participating shareholder, if I saw the ordinary shareholders getting a dividend of X, I wouldn't say, you know, where's my piece and why, you know, why am I not getting that? So I think just thinking through whether it makes sense to illustrate that piece of the fact pattern submitted in terms of how it works through, would at least benefit from some kind of comment. If the committee, you know, and I'm looking to Sue as I say this, you know, thinking about how you run the discussion about what's the role of examples, if the committee wants to publish the example as part of the agenda decision package as opposed to it kind of being proof of concept for the committee's consideration and available via the paper. I think there's some things we may be looking at through the lens of the discussion that could come back to bite people if it survived independent of the fact patterns.
Okay. And with that, I'm not quite sure how to call the votes, but I guess, firstly, a show of hands maybe on whether the, because I think one, we could have thought about the example as being proof of concept, to use Mary's words, because I think one of the reasons it came up last time was just to check we didn't have double counting, we all understood what the sort of more than one period consequence was, so maybe that was all its purpose in life was. But then arguably maybe it's also helpful, even though it's very simplified, to at least illustrate mechanics to make sure people understand what the words mean. So I guess, first of all, maybe I could get a show of hands on who thinks that the example has sort of served its purpose in being a proof of concept and doesn't need a life beyond this agenda paper. If I could maybe have a show of hands for that, first of all. No, we all love the example. Works well. Then I guess the next question is, given that it is going to have some sort of officialish status, no matter where it gets placed, if it's part of the decision and an illustration of the decision in a sense, is the committee overall happy to move forward with finalising the agenda decision along with the example at this point without any additional exposure, and then I'll come back and ask the other question. So is the committee comfortable to move forward with the agenda decision and example at this stage? Can I see a show of hands.
Two, three, four.
I'm raising my hand.
Eight, six, seven, eight, and four, nine.
Nine. So, yes. Okay. And a majority is enough because it does make me feel a little bit.
Yeah. I'd only one question back, I suppose, is Bonnie mentioned adding something more to the agenda decision, maybe along the lines of Mary, because the point you were raising from the paper, Bonnie, I think linked to Mary's point about the assumption she felt uncomfortable with. I don't know whether we want to add anything on that, and then if we do add it, whether we still go forward. The other thing, if it gives any comfort to the point that Mary raised, is that whilst, yes, we put in the assumptions that were in the fact pattern we submitted, on the particular assumption, Mary, that you mentioned, that sort of makes you be slightly, I don't know whether uncomfortable is the right word, but we did have a footnote already in the example that we proposed to retain that at least tried to address that and said, look, this is the assumption, if the assumption were different.
So there is something there. My sense is that's very subtle. Mm-hmm. I'd be inclined to agree with Bonnie.
Okay. I wonder whether to err on the side of caution, even though you have been helpful in terms of saying we could move forward with the example attached, whether we should move forward and finalise the agenda decision but take the opportunity to expose for comment the example, just to double check that the example hasn't sort of added, doesn't raise its own issues in isolation, if the committee would be comfortable with that.
If it's part of the agenda decision, how can you finalise one piece and not
the
other?
Yeah, I don't think we can do that.
I don't really want to re-expose something we've already exposed, though. It's a bit weird.
But we're adding something. If everyone agrees to add that piece, which I think is important, then we are changing some part of the agenda decision. Or clarifying, perhaps, not changing, but
I think it may be hard for people outside the inner circle of interpretation committee, if there is such a thing as that, to understand the distinction between wording and know we're thinking again about whether or not we've reached the right decision. And I think Sue's point about not re-exposing, as it were, is that I think I've heard anybody from the committee say, well, maybe we should take on a project and not inadvertently signal that you're thinking about backtracking on that piece of this. I think that's the challenge.
Well, and actually I think that given we've got enough votes to issue it, I think maybe we should issue it, but be careful and just do a little bit of extra work making sure that people are comfortable with the clarity of the words in the example, that doesn't have unintended consequences. So let's just be extra careful on the drafting of that.
It's the same approach we would take with adding an example.
Read your minds, gentlemen.
You did.
That's
you did.
Great minds thinking a lot. Okay, on that basis we'll proceed.
This is when the wheels fall. We were doing so well.
Okay, it's all been going really well so far, guys. So.
5 minutes.
Okay, so moving on to 6D, centrally cleared.
Agenda paper 6D, centrally cleared client derivatives. Previously, the committee reached a tentative agenda decision clarifying the accounting for centrally cleared client derivative contracts from the perspective of the clearing member. We received 5 comment letters. 3 of them agreed with the tentative agenda decision. One respondent gave some wording suggestions, and another respondent suggested clarifying the decisions a bit further. We have summarized and analyzed the comment letters in paragraphs 5 through to 14.
As a result, we recommend confirming the tentative agenda decision with minor wording changes, as described in paragraph A1. These changes emphasize the importance of the scoping requirements of IFRS 9 or IAS 39, rather than the defined term financial instruments, because there are certain contractual arrangements within the scope of IFRS 9 or IAS 39 which do not meet the definition of a financial instrument. These arrangements are certain contracts to buy or sell non-financial items, such as certain commodity contracts.
And it's over.
Okay. Any comments? People happy? Take a show of hands. And Sandy, everyone?
I don't have any additional comments.
And you're happy to proceed?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's everybody. Well done, please.
Do you need us, yes?
No, just because. Well, just a show of hands for the next one. No, we're well ahead of schedule, and I won't see it as failure if you don't fill all of the time that was allotted. And the only other thing I will say before I hand it over to the staff is, at the end of the day, I'm going to ask you a very simple question. Do you want to proceed with the agenda decision, or do you not?
This is what the 80 minutes was allotted to.
Okay. In March 2017, the Interpretations Committee issued a tentative agenda decision regarding the accounting for a modification or exchange of a financial liability measured at amortized cost that does not result in the derecognition of the financial liability. The matter under consideration applies to financial liabilities only. The committee noted that any adjustment from a modification or an exchange to the amortized cost of the financial liability is recognized in profit or loss as income or expense. We have analyzed 13 comment letters on the agenda decision, which have been reproduced in Appendix B to the paper. Many of the respondents disagreed with the finalization of the agenda decision. However, the comment letters did not provide any new information on the committee's technical conclusion. The main comments on the technical conclusions in the agenda decisions and our analysis of those comments can be found in paragraphs 9 to 31 of the paper. In our view, the committee had already considered those points when reaching its tentative agenda decision. Consequently, we recommend the committee does not make any changes to the wording of the tentative agenda decision in response to the concerns raised. Many respondents expressed concerns about communicating the committee's conclusion with an agenda decision. They would have preferred an interpretation or an amendment to IFRS 9. The committee and the board have previously acknowledged the importance of the issue. Although the board concluded that standard setting is not required in this situation, it said it will consider other ways to highlight this matter. The feedback from respondents confirms the need for such other means. However, similarly to the technical comments, respondents have not provided new information about the need for standard setting beyond that considered by the committee when reaching its tentative agenda decision. Consequently, we recommend that the committee finalize the agenda decision and support it by other means to highlight the relevant accounting. The proposed wording for the final agenda decision is reproduced in Appendix A to the paper. It is unchanged from the tentative agenda decision as published in the March 2017 IFRIC update. So we are asking you today whether you agree with the staff recommendation to finalize the agenda decision.
Thanks, Bid.
I certainly agree with the conclusions in the agenda decision, but what the comment letters really pointed out to me were, they raised a number of concerns in my mind. One is that people are clearly focused on the structuring opportunities that are presented by the different treatment of fees and costs versus the cash flows otherwise associated with the modification of financial liabilities. And so I'm concerned that people will be structuring to try to get out of this simply because people don't really like it. So that raises a concern in my mind. And then the second thing is some of the comment letters hint at that because people really haven't focused on this issue in the past and now starting to focus on it, it's raising all kinds of ancillary issues, such as what happens when you have fixed rate debt that becomes floating rate, and there are instances where that occurs. How do you apply the guidance? How do you determine modification or exchanges? Now, certainly, the principles are in IFRS 9. I accept that. It's just, as I say, I have a degree of caution about where this may lead and whether, in fact, it may result in either people doing things to avoid the accounting, or whether, which is not a good thing, or just raising all kinds of follow-up questions that we will have to deal with as a committee.
Okay, Bertrand?
Probably like Reinhardt, I was surprised by the alignment or form of alignment of the letters received. And notably, there were four coming from France, so I did some outreach there. There's still in France a disagreement with the technical outcome that was reached. At the same time, I think there's also a desire to move forward, so just to, and they have no choice, I must say. The only concern I have, and I must admit it's shared, and it's a constant concern I've expressed since we discussed the first time this issue, is the transition. This is not, in my mind, properly dealt with at this stage. It's probably the, let's put it that way, ongoing. I think, even though I'm speaking about France, but probably it's more general than that, or it could be. I don't know if other members will comment on that. But what I understand is that even if they disagree with the outcome, I think they finally accepted it, or they will accept the change. So ongoing is not the problem. The problem is really the transition between the previous widespread practice and the new reading of IFRS 9. So they're a bit stuck in the middle, let's put it that way. So that's my only concern is there, is on now trying to see whether we can find a solution for this. So I'm not familiar really with this portion of the due process, but I've noticed page 11 that after considering there's a footnote saying after considering those comments, the Interpretations Committee will either confirm its decision and issue a rejection notice, add the issue to its work program, or refer the matter to the ISB. I remind that initially we were told that the IFRS Interpretations Committee was asked with a question, it was a question that for which the ISB would provide the answer, and so the IFRS Interpretations Committee was just consulted on this issue. So I think it would be probably at the end more proper to refer the final decision to the ISB. And so I would probably more favor, instead of finalizing at this stage at our level the agenda decision, refer that back to the ISB to perform the finalization.
And just on that for a second, so I think that it's in everyone's interest, both ours and also people in the market, that we don't get into a situation where there's too much ping-ponging between us and the board, because it's not helpful given where people are at with IFRS 9, and just as a general proposition, it's not best practice. So I think that, and given that it's already been to the board and the board have decided that they didn't think that standard setting activity was needed and they asked the committee to look at it again, if the committee decides not to issue an agenda decision, I think it will naturally go back to the board again and then the board will decide what to do. Is that fair, staff? Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that will be the next step. Youngs.
I generally agree with the staff analysis and conclusion, but my thought is the same as Reinhardt and the Bertrand about two issues. The first issue was raised by Reinhardt about the accounting for fees and costs. The standard I think is clear about the accounting for fees and costs and the the modified cash flows, modified the financial instrument that is not derecognized, but their interaction is not that clear, I think. So that I think it's better to include some kind of interaction between the accounting for fees and costs and the accounting for the modified financial instrument without recognition. The reason why I'm saying that is because we said we're going to be more like educative instead of just agenda decision. So if we include that example or any ideas about that interaction, this agenda decision can be more educative and helpful for the practitioners. That's the first point I want to say. And the other one, I agree with Bertrand about the transition rule. And the basic ideas about this agenda decision is the amortized cost concept. And amortized cost concept has not been changed between IAS 39 and IFRS 9. So the same concept goes through the old standard and new standard. And if we issue this agenda decision, I'm not really sure what the companies or entities are going to do. Do they have to apply this agenda decision from this year, instantly, or this period, or from next year, from 2018. My point is that the vision, the underlying vision for this agenda decision has not been changed between the old accounting standard and the new accounting standard.
That's true, but we're trying to be helpful to the market. So we're trying to be helpful to the market by focusing on the specific words that were added into IFRS 9 that is a new piece of information. And the agenda decision sets out how the board expects the mechanics to work both for assets and liabilities. So the way that the agenda decision was designed was to enable entities to make a change of accounting policy at the point in time that they moved to IFRS 9 if this was different to what they were doing under 39. So even though nobody in their letters has really acknowledged it, it was an attempt to actually try to be helpful.
Very clear. Yeah.
John?
Thanks. Obviously the weight of the comment letters shows that there's not a lot of love for this particular agenda decision. We realized that when we discussed this issue initially, and that's why the Interpretations Committee decided that this ought to be a matter that maybe should go to interpretation to draw out the sort of connections within the standard that gave you the technical conclusion. I mean, the board decided not to do that was not necessary. So I don't know that we really should be having a huge debate now about the problems of transition and what type of transition relief people might need. The board have already decided the standard is sufficient. I think it's this Interpretations Committee's role to either say in its agenda decision that the guidance in the standard is sufficient to determine the accounting, which I personally think it is, and we say that and we move on. I don't know that there's any point in us sending this back to the board for more deliberation and just delaying the inevitable when the standard says what the standard says. I think this committee's role is to say what the standard says, and I support the recommendation of the staff to finalise the agenda decision.
Thanks, John. Tony?
So I guess I share some of the concerns that people have talked about previously. I agree that if I had a blank sheet of paper and IFRS 9, I think I would support the technical conclusion. Having said that, we've had sort of 13 or 14 comment letters that are not comfortable that an agenda decision is the way to go forward. I sense there are several reasons behind that. I think there are a number of issues that would have been debated had everybody been aware that this is where IFRS 9 was taking us. So I completely understand the technical logic for the conclusion, but I think pretty much all of the boards and our constituents did not understand that's where IFRS 9 was going to end up, and that it was going to be a significant change from what was done under IS 39. And I think if people had, there would have been a number of issues that were listed in the various comment letters that probably would have been debated. So around the boundary between what does fall into something that might be treated as an amendment to the effective interest rate and what ends up being a catch-up adjustment or the potential for arbitrage in connection with fees and costs. And I guess I'm concerned that that debate hasn't happened. And I share the concerns of Bertrand and Young Su about the absence of transition relief, because I think this is one of those things that could be fairly difficult, notwithstanding the conversation we had before lunch, that could be fairly difficult to apply retrospectively. Not maybe impracticable, but still very difficult to go back to the origination of the instrument and roll it forward. And while I think I take the point that there's maybe not much that we didn't talk about in the feedback through the comment letters, but there is still a fairly consistent message that maybe an agenda decision is not the way to go forward. So I think I share the concerns of some others about going ahead with the agenda decision.
As others have said in this nice topic in previous meetings, I feel very torn in this one. I can see the technical analysis and where the agenda decision goes, and that in isolation takes you to one particular answer. And then I look at the big pile of comment letters. I haven't gone back in history, but I suspect it's the largest number of comment letters we've ever received in relation to a draft agenda decision. And like Tony, I worry a little bit that it's not just this that people haven't thought about in all that much detail. It's the consequences that happen once you start to apply this, and what else in the big row of dominoes then falls over. So I feel troubled in finalizing the agenda decision, because I am worried that there are other things out there that we haven't seen. And it may be that one thing to do is to look at some of those other things and consider whether there are consequential effects that haven't popped their heads up above the parapet just yet. I also worry about transition. We're 6 months from the date of initial application of IFRS 9. And while there are some companies in sectors that don't renegotiate debt very often, there are companies elsewhere that do renegotiate debt very frequently. And this is fully retrospective with absolutely no relief. And I can see this being extraordinarily difficult in practical terms. Now, that's a practical issue rather than a technical one. But I do think that we need to consider that quite carefully. One potential thing that we could do, and I'll just sidle slightly away to avoid being kicked too hard because I'm beside a board member. but I wonder whether in the context of all of the different moving parts that we have, all of the potential consequential implications that maybe haven't come up yet, and transition, that is this something where we ask the board to reconsider? Now, this may be deeply unpopular with some people, but I just wonder whether it is, because it is a very, very difficult issue for many, and quite aside from that, I'm worried about the unintended consequences.
I'll try not to contribute to the debate, as nobody will be surprised. I have very, very strong feelings on this topic, but just to respond specifically to that, I think that when the board put what we saw as confirmations, I wouldn't even say clarifications, but confirmations in IFRS 9 about how you dealt with modifications of contractual cash flows and the interaction with impairment, in particular on the asset side, but thinking about modifications more generally for amortized cost measurement, we believed that changes in contractual cash flows, even more so than changes in estimates, should cause catch-up adjustments, and I don't think anything would cause us to change that. And I also think that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that having spent 5 years or whatever it was deliberating IFRS 9 and getting it out the door, it's awfully early days to ask the board to consider something which I think is pretty fundamental to how the amortised cost mechanics work.
I'll leave it
at that. And, yes. And I think the other thing is the board has already looked at this issue and decided the words were clear. And I think we need to have be mindful of that as well.
I was just going to add one factual point, was just only to add that just when the board talked about this then even more recently in February, it was an all board member versus zero vote in terms of how they viewed it, at least at that time, with all of the information they had available then. So.
Just wanted to remind the people that this is about liabilities. The questions which are being raised about all the other things equally apply to assets, and I think the board debated it. It was debated by the board, by the ITG, quite a bit. So I think these things people are aware, and this treatment is no different for a significant part of the balance sheet, which is the asset side, which has been debated, and the technique and the methodology is exactly the same for both sides. So that's one of the reasons why also I think the board considered it, and I think it will be challenging for us to go back and say this is something we open up again.
I do agree with the staff that all the issues that were raised in the comment letters have been surfaced in our discussions before, except one. The one piece of new information that we have that we didn't have was all these comment letters, where we had a near unanimous reaction to that this should be done through standard setting rather than through an agenda decision. So I think that's something to keep in mind. The one issue that keeps, though, gnawing at me, what came up late at the last meeting that we had, was this issue around the accounting for transaction costs versus modification. And that you could have this, the different answers, one with the transaction cost you amortize over the remaining period, and the modification you would take into P&L, the effect into P&L immediately. This really wasn't addressed in the paper. We really didn't, I think, have a good answer when last time we discussed it. Do we know? Maybe it was from another agenda decision we had. Do we know how to differentiate between when something's a transaction cost versus a modification of the contractual cash flows?
When you say, the source of the history of this, Bob, is that it's been there in the standard and it applies equally, as I said, for everything. Mm-hmm. I do not doubt you can merge one with the other. That structuring is there for everything. I don't think we ever had a discussion on putting down what are the guidance on how to make a cut on what is a transaction cost and what is a change in modification. Yes, that we haven't discussed, and I don't think it was ever a question which was raised.
No, but it will become a question that will now come out of this, won't it?
Why only for liabilities?
Why what?
Only for liabilities.
I'm not saying only for liabilities.
That's what I'm saying. This has there been around, people have handled it, we haven't had a question, but I personally, that's the point I'm making. It applies equally to both sides. Absolutely, it can become a question, as with the case, because in FI, you can merge the two EIRs very clearly.
So what kind of bothers me personally is drawing out an agenda decision without that's going to raise another issue, highlight another issue. I recognize it's been an issue all along, but now it's coming to light.
And I do agree. I think it is it's a fair question. I know I've got ways I'd fix that, which won't be the ways you'd want to fix it. But
exactly. That was always an exception which was provided.
But I think, and so, and with our clarification on the 10% test as well, maybe that will also cause it to come up more than it used to. But I think that the question we've just been asked here, is it true you want that we meant that there's meant to be modification adjustments for liabilities as well as assets? And I think it would be nice to be able to answer that question for people. I agree there are other questions. There's also modification and exchange questions. There's a whole suite of stuff if we really wanted to get into it. But I think what we're trying to do is to be disciplined and to keep it to this particular issue. So at that point, I think what I'll do is just ask a simple question of the committee, which is a show of hands for those who would support the staff recommendation to finalise the agenda decision as set out in paper 6E.
On the basis of time.
Okay.
I'm sorry, did you say on the phone?
Yeah.
I agree with finalising the agenda decision.
Five. Okay, so that's not enough. So
to come back
we'll
to the board.
We'll deal with it. Yeah. Right, so moving on.